Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Congress is taking a little time off. We'll touch base in a bit with our Jim Howard for a look at what's ahead and the record so far. But first, as Congress takes a break, college students are getting ready to return to campus. We'll check on what they have to look forward to in the Southern Illinois University system. Like most colleges and universities, SIU, Edwardsville, and Carbondale are facing challenges. As part of our summer series on higher education, we'll talk about them and how they are being addressed with Dr. Randy Dunn, the president of the SIU system. He's also currently serving as acting chancellor at SIU in Carbondale, and he joins me in studio. So nice to have you with us.
Don, it's good to join you this afternoon.
These are tough times for colleges and universities.
To say the least. So true.
We'll get into some specifics on that. But if you would, Randy, start with the kind of a profile of your system, how it's structured and number of students, that sort of thing.
Well, SIU is actually one of the smaller public university systems in the country. And if you think about SIU writ large, it's really comprised of three main campuses. We have the somewhat larger campus in Carbondale, and it's within that sector of institutions known as the National Research Universities. So it has fairly robust doctoral programming, a large research enterprise. Our campus here in Edwardsville, just across the river, is within that group of institutions known as the regional or comprehensive universities. There is very limited doctoral programming, large offering of master's degrees, and of course, undergraduate education, hugely important there, as well as at Carbondale. And then our medical school operates in Springfield, Illinois, and it has a very large footprint throughout the central and southern part of the state. And then beyond that, we have a number of other locations. Many listeners probably are aware that our School of Dental Medicine is in the old Shiflett College campus up in Alton, Illinois. We operate a higher education center in East St. Louis that has a lot of enrollment, not just of the typical university students, but we also run the East St. Louis Charter School and some other operations there. Our School of Medicine has clinics all over central and southern Illinois. So when you think about the operation of the system as a whole, it is a big player in this part of the state of Illinois. We're about $1 billion operation, a little less if you look at everything that we do in terms of the scope of our operations and services. And of course, in this business, there's always more to do, always more that we can take on. But as alluded to in your intro, our challenge right now, of course, is the status of the state budget and some of the challenges we have in front of us there.
That's the elephant in the room
these days, isn't it? Yes, it is. There's no doubt about it.
How is that impacting what you do?
Well, you know, to some degree, Don, the impact is just a growing uncertainty about what is in the future for us. So if you think about SIU as a system being anywhere from a $900 million to $1 billion operation, depending upon what you count in that, we would get about $200 million in a typical year from the state of Illinois. While it's not a majority of our operating budget, it's still a big chunk. We rely on that contribution from our citizens and taxpayers. And at this point, with no state budget enacted, we don't know how much of that $200 million we may see. And until that budget is decided upon, there is no appropriations bill. We're getting no state funding. Nothing is coming to us at this point. So we're having to rely totally on money coming in from tuition income, other local sources, grants and contracts. And when you consider that a sizable part of our grant and contract work comes from the state of Illinois or federal dollars flowing through the state budget, which have to be appropriated, it is putting the squeeze on cash flow right now. Now, we're okay going into fall as tuition income comes in, as students are paying for housing contracts and things of that nature. We're okay for a while, but we can't go forever just on local income, and eventually we have to see a fix to the state budget.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but it's my understanding, even if there were a state budget approved right now, that you'd still be looking at a significant decrease in funding.
Well, that's right, and that is part of the longer-term uncertainty. Some listeners will recall that Governor Rauner, newly inaugurated in the state of Illinois, proposed in his budget back in February about a 31.5% cut to higher education, nearly a third of our state funding. That would have meant a loss of about $62 million plus or minus to the system. Devastating. Now, we went through, of course, the spring session of the General Assembly, advocated, told our story, and the General Assembly passed a budget at the end of May that instead gave us a haircut of about 8.75%. Bad enough, but we were ready to deal with that, to respond to it. But of course, that budget was vetoed by the governor. And at this point, there's no appropriation for higher education that's been advanced. So we sit and wait. But we take from that that even in the best case scenario, whenever a budget for Illinois gets done, whether it's August, September, December, who knows when, that our picture won't be any better than an 8 to 9% cut. And depending on things, how things come out in terms of a decision on increased revenue for the state, whether or not we see that, we could be still looking at a fairly significant loss of state support into that 15 to 20% range.
And what does that mean? I'm sure you're doing some what-if contingency planning. What specifically are you looking at?
You know, we've spent all this spring and well into the summer at all of the campuses doing that what-if contingency planning. And without giving you a laundry list, I can tell you generally the way that each campus has worked through that, and I can say this from the standpoint, as you announced in your introduction of me, as a campus CEO as well, in that I'm serving as acting chancellor for the Carbondale campus. We've tried to preserve as much as possible the academic programs that lead to our students getting degrees and getting out the door as productive citizens. We've tried to save the critical student services that our students need, and then take our cuts more from the things we do to provide regional support and services, and to some degree the academic support programs and services, and go there first. So, for instance, and I'll give you some examples of this. In fact, one comes to mind as we're sitting in these studios today. We use a considerable amount of state dollars to support our public broadcasting enterprises across the system. We don't want to lose that, but at the same time, we're having to look at how we might be able to pull back some on that subsidy and get that covered with other sponsorships and fundraising and outside support. At the Carbondale campus, there's a huge venue there. It's called Touch of Nature, and it's a beautiful environmental outdoor education center that we use a considerable amount of state money to support. We have something similar at the Edwardsville campus that we refer to as the Gardens. These are important places that have a lot of programming and services for the region, but the question now arises, can we continue to put state money there? Economic development is a huge operation at both Carbondale and Edwardsville. There are many aspects of the School of Medicine operations that we support for clinical outreach and taking health to rural communities, things of that nature. All of those we're going to have to take a very close look at pulling back on with the state dollars, depending upon where this budget cut goes.
Significant impact, obviously.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, one of the things, Don, that I talk about that is hugely important, given the role of the state university in our country. And I'm not talking about the Mizzou's and the University of Illinois of the world. I'm talking about these strong campuses that you see away from the flagships, away from the large public institutions. We are the stewards of the places where we're located. We are the stewards of the places we serve. SIU has a huge geographic footprint in central and southern Illinois, and our citizens rely upon the university. They have for generations. They rely upon SIU to provide service and support in economic development, jobs creation, health and wellness, arts and culture, historic preservation that add tremendously to the quality of life of the people within our region. And what worries me as much as anything is the fact that we may have to start pulling back on that or look for other sources of revenue to allow us to continue that work, because we still at the heart of our operations are about getting students progressed timely toward degrees, getting them graduated, and out being successful as citizens within a larger society.
Your situation in terms of a financial crunch is not unique.
Not at all.
We had a guest on last week, Mark Lombardi from Maryville University, who told us that 70% of the colleges and universities in this country are losing money, and that 700, that's seven with two zeros, are going to have to close down because of this financial situation. But, you know, the public looks at numbers like this and said, wait a minute, they're charging so much money that
yes.
these kids are leaving with $100,000 in debt. That
yes.
seems sort of more than ironic.
Yes. Well, you know, Don, there are a lot of different ways to go with your comment. Clearly, the institutions such as what President Lombardi oversees, the smaller liberal arts schools are going to have a challenging time in the years ahead. We're starting to see right now the early waves of difficulty hitting the beach for those types of institutions, and that's not going to change. For the state universities, we have to kind of rethink our mix of programs and services, and a lot of things that we do add to our overall pricing, and we understand that. At the same time, if you think about attracting that typical first-time freshman, that traditional college student, that student and that student's family generally desire a rich experience on a campus with a lot of student life. That is at the heart of what we do at both Edwardsville and Carbondale. We do understand that others are going to be, particularly non-traditional students, adult students, don't want to pay for all of that. And you're going to see tremendous growth of online programs or universities that market specifically to adult students without all of the fun things that create a great college experience maybe, but are very targeted toward degree completion. And all of this is to say that we're seeing a splintering of the business, the industry of higher education, and more market niches that are getting developed, and not having one-size-fits-all approaches to higher education. And for places like us that have been, you know, fat and sassy over the years, it means we're going to have to be much more flexible and think about our business model going forward to deal with these various groups.
That's precisely what he
yes,
says, the
absolutely.
Change in the business model. Have to take a break now. We're talking with Dr. Randy Dunn. He is the president of the SIU system in Southern Illinois. And as you've heard, it has problems, just as most institutions of higher learning do these days. We'll come back and continue our conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Randy Dunn. You mentioned online training, and I had mentioned to you before we went on the air that I'd read over the weekend that the University of Missouri is now going to be offering a 10% tuition cut for full-time online students.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to myself, okay, here we go. What do you think?
They have engaged the market in a very exciting and interesting way. In fact, one of the things that we have to look at SIU is how we can continue to position ourselves to take advantage of this huge growth in online education. And of course, Don, one of the things that I shared back with you is the fact that in our pricing for online, and this is very common across a number of institutions, a wide range of institutions, there's actually a premium in pricing for online. The argument being that you're still having to pay for the faculty member, the professor or instructor to run the course, and online is not an easier approach to teaching. In fact, in some ways, it's tougher. It's more challenging. So you're paying for all the typical things that a student expects, and then there's the add-on, if you will, of the technology needed to provide a vibrant online program. So it's not unusual to see a little extra, a little premium paid to do an online course. So the move by Mizzou is going to be a wake-up call to a number of us to say, you know, we're seeing the plate shift here a little bit in how we do pricing. And they're going to be even larger players in that market with this change, and there's no doubt that it's going to cause others to take a look, think it through, and possibly follow suit.
Is this, do you think, part of the changed business model?
Oh, there's no doubt about it, yes. In fact, we talk about that on the campuses, and I can guarantee you that every president of a four-year institution is going through this. So when you sit with the faculty senate or have a faculty meeting and you start talking about the business model, it tends to provide a little unsettledness and concern and worry, and the faculty members rightly would say that we're not a business. But these operating models or these approaches that we're using, as mentioned by your comment on Mizzou's online pricing, are shifting under us right now. We see that happening. I mentioned earlier the fact that the non-traditional and adult market is so much larger than what it used to be, with adults coming back for completer programs, for instance. You see student debt is a concern, and pricing is a much larger consideration now than it has been in the past. So as we look to acquire or add on new services and programs, we're always thinking, how does this impact the bottom line, and should we, you know, is the value added by something you're bringing in to the offerings of the university going to provide enough support and sustaining power over time to warrant the investment? And these are all business questions, operating questions, that many of us in higher education have been shielded from for many, many years. Those days are gone, particularly as we look at how states are funding higher education, and we're going to be in the midst of making those decisions along with every other institution, or at least every other public institution.
I'd like to invite the members of our listening audience to get into this conversation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. Dunn, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org. If you'd prefer to send a tweet, do so at STL on Air. The question I have about online education, and I've heard critics of it,
yes,
suggest that you just can't be educated as well. The quality will not be as high.
Well, you know, Don, I don't subscribe to that notion, but I do think there has to be a thoughtful approach. And I can say this having been a faculty member. I've come up, on the academic side of the house from the experience of teaching not just in a traditional classroom setting, but in a distance setting as well as online. And I can tell you there are strengths and weaknesses to every approach. And what I sense is that we're going to see more and more over time, not totally, but I think we're going to see more and more over time these blended approaches that combine a significant amount of online instruction, but also require some coming together, whether it's weekends at a campus or some summer sessions or whatever the case may be, with a face-to-face classroom presence. And I think we're going to see that as the more dominant model over time. But for online degree programs, I think there just has to be care taken and an analysis, a thoughtful analysis, about whether a certain field lends itself to online instruction. But this default that many people have to say you can't do preparation for certain professions online, I think what you see now is a real rethinking of that, particularly given the role of technology and what can be provided on this computer screen that both you and I are looking at in terms of some very specific skills training that we always thought had to be done in a lab or in a studio and now can be done in simulated version right on a computer.
That's exactly where I wanted to go, because aside from the online aspect of it, you know, I'm wondering how today's digital world is changing the way we teach and curriculum.
It's changed it dramatically because of the real life opportunities that now come from technology, as opposed to, again, having to go on a farm or in a lab or a studio or classroom to get a range of learning experiences that now are no longer place bound or site bound. And you're going to continue to see that. In fact, we're living in kind of this amazing, not just transitional time, but transformational time for higher education. And having spent part of my life on the K-12 side, I think I can dare say for education generally, where we're going to see these models just continue to, you know, to kind of bloom and go out all kinds of different directions. It's really going to be quite amazing over the next quarter century.
I'll bet when you started all of this that you had no idea it would be going
in this
direction.
You know, I started teaching school. As I mentioned, my background was in K-12 and kind of finished that part of my career as state superintendent of schools in Illinois. Mm-hmm. And have a lot of experience on that side of the ledger, if you will. But when I started teaching, we had the old TRS from Radio Shack doing this very simple programming. And to think, just over the arc of my career, now about 35 or 36 years, what's happened, it's really the most astounding thing one could imagine.
Yes, it's moved so
Nature of education and why this profession is as exciting as any other, to see how these things happen and then change the face of what we do.
In view of that, do you think we are a better educated society than we were when you started?
Well, we are a better educated society if you look at the general indications of that. We haven't had strong growth, but we've, you know, kind of kept chipping away over time at, trying to keep the line moving forward instead of back. And so we've gotten these small wins over the past 20 to 30 years in education. The challenge, and I'm talking now more on the K-12 side, the challenge there has been where we might see an increase in one area, then we fall back in another. So, for instance, when I was state superintendent of schools, there was a big push on reading education, literacy, and we invested heavily there, and you see a little bump in the scores that come over time, but then you see a drop off somewhere else. Here's where I think we have a real challenge, though. The gaps, the achievement gaps, have not moved a lot. So even though all scores may be ever so slightly, you know, pushing forward, the gaps are not closing. And in some areas right now, they're getting wider. And this is true if you look at higher education as well if you look at K-12 education. So when we talk about the gaps, they would be for racial ethnic groups, they would be for disadvantaged students or at-risk students, and we've got to figure out a way to pick the lock on that if we're really going to have some sense of equality and equity moving forward in the education system writ large. And at this point, we haven't had a lot of success there.
No, there have been a number of surveys just here recently which show that it is very dramatic and very upsetting.
Yes.
Let's take a call. We have Brian wanting to join us from St. Louis. Brian, come on into the conversation with Dr. Randy Dunn.
Yeah, good afternoon. Great show. So what I've seen in higher ed over the last 25 years are two concurrent trends. One, with increasing reliance on low-paid non-benefit adjunct workers, and then the other is an increase of administration and ancillary positions in the university that make more than faculty. So, for example, you have a development officer or a campus police chief who makes more than a department chair. Do you believe that this is sustainable?
I first of all would say to the caller, I agree with the two trends he's seeing. And in fact, if you look at any set of indicators, they're borne out. We've seen growth in both of those areas. The non-tenure track faculty, or the use of adjuncts to come in and teach a course or teach even on a full-time basis without being tenured, as well as administrative growth. And those aren't sustainable. Let's talk about the non-tenure first. As budgets have gotten tighter and tighter, particularly in public higher education, there's been this growing reliance on not investing in tenure or tenure-track faculty who would have significant research responsibilities, but just pulling in adjuncts, if you will, to get courses covered. And we do that. And I think we're getting to a point on a number of our campuses where we're getting past some threshold that is not investing in the future of the university as we keep shrinking those tenure and tenure track lines. So I think every campus has to enter into this decision, or at least a conversation about what the right mix is. But I would submit to you that when you're getting to a point where more than half of the coursework is being taught by individuals who aren't on the tenure track or are tenured themselves, engaged in research, doing public service. And these non-tenure faculty, by the way, they're the real workhorses. They're teaching a load of courses. They're not getting time to do research. There are no service responsibilities given to them. And they come in and they're teaching, just a tremendous load. And the backs of the campuses, to some degree, are being carried or falling on them to carry. So we've got to get that percentage or that proportion, I think, back to a realistic spot to allow the university to grow, to be engaged in the research activities that it needs to be undertaking, as well as the public service work that I said is so important. On the administrative side, there is no doubt that you can see tremendous growth in the number of administrators, percentage of administrators, administrative costs, and we're going to have to look at ways to pull that back. In Illinois, one of the initiatives that we're hearing is going to be part of Governor Rauner's agenda going forward is pulling back on administrative costs. But it is the case, and the caller mentioned it or at least alluded to it to some degree, many, many things that we do on a campus fall under administrative costs. So if you think, for instance, about I think the example he used had to do with the police chief of the campus or someone who's an academic advisor. Or, in fact, the other day I just happened to go over to our student health service on the Carbondale campus. We operate a full-blown clinic that competes with any clinic that you'll walk into. Offered by any other health provider. All of those things are so-called administrative costs, but they create the campus environment, the climate, the offerings of programs and services that many, many of our residential campuses expect. But there's no doubt that we're going to have to pull back and get those controlled in some fashion. And what that's going to mean is pulling back on the number of administrators, getting leaner in terms of the administrative lines, if you will, and doing things that we can do to get the proportion of administrative costs under control because they cannot keep growing like they are. And the legislators clearly have that same question in their sights as they look at the state support they provide and what it's getting used for.
Just out of curiosity, you can give this in percentages if you can. What is the difference in compensation for a tenured professor and an adjunct professor?
Oh, at our campuses, you would see a full tenured professor in some fields. It's very much driven by discipline. But in some fields, you might see a full tenured professor making well over three times what a non-tenured faculty member would coming in teaching courses, no doubt about it. Mm-hmm. And that gets even more disparate as you get into some of the high-paid disciplines such as law, accounting, that type of thing.
Yeah. Let's take another call. Our time is winding down, but we have time for David in Webster Groves. Go ahead, David. You're on the air with Randy Dunn.
Hi. I'm calling. I'm not a member of any of your systems, but the example that I think of was my wife's college, which is a small liberal arts college in Wisconsin. And they just got probably about 5 years ago, a very glamorous, very large science building that was a donation from just one or two very, very wealthy patrons. And I'm wondering, does the university ever market the idea of, you know, your wealthier donors doing something to keep those future costs down for students, more of a how can we increase the general lifestyle of the future students rather than only giving these great big glamorous projects, which seems to be the norm over the last 15 years.
Well, David's hitting on a great point there that we do wrestle with, and it's great to have that type of donor who can come in and provide that building or that thing that otherwise might not get done. But that is a challenge that does exist in fundraising, in higher education philanthropy. If you have donors at the very highest end of giving, they tend to come with a very specific idea of what they want that giving to be for, and it may be for that, in the case of the call, that building or that thing on a campus that maybe speaks to a particular desire that the donor has for the gift, but maybe isn't what's really needed to move the institution as a whole forward. So we do try to spend a lot of time with individuals, not just at the highest end, but all of our donors, talking about the general needs of the campus, talking about that transformational story that comes from supporting scholarship endowments or providing money for study abroad or doing things to help provide support for internships and externships. Those are the things that the students at SIU many times need. But at times, it can be hard to get that more generic purpose sold with a donor, particularly the very large donors who are coming wanting to put their name on something. Well, we try, Don, to love all of our donors and to talk with them to find out the right thing that will have the donor feel satisfied in the gift but also advance what the institution's trying to accomplish.
It can be a little dicey. No question about that. I don't have time to take Ben's call from Lake St. Louis, but he'll raise a point. Justification for spending on athletics over education.
And I know we're running out of time. Here's the quick version of this, Don, and many listeners know it. If an institution desires to have a Division I athletic program except for about 22 to 25 to 30 schools in the country, it is going to be subsidized. Everybody who's in Division I, other than those huge SEC, Big Ten types of schools, are going to have some sort of campus subsidy. So as I talk to our board about both Cougar Athletics in Edwardsville and Saluki Athletics in Carbondale, the question is, what is the appropriate level of subsidy? What is that subsidy buying, and what's the opportunity cost in having to do that? What are the expenses that are forcing it? You know, if we're flying people all over, student athletes all over creation, and being exorbitant in our use of funds, that's not right. But if an institution has made the determination to do Division I athletics, there's going to be a subsidy. The question is, is it being reviewed? Is it being controlled? And then what is the source of funds to cover the subsidy? That's just kind of the nature of life in big-time college athletics now.
Just a few seconds left, and I just want to put this on the table because it's something everybody's talking about with regard to higher education. That is campus security.
Yes.
Major issue, national issue.
Absolutely.
How are you dealing with it in Carbondale?
You know, and Edwardsville? We do the things that all campuses are doing. We've tried to beef up our police forces at each of the campuses, ensure that we have the essentials to provide a safe and secure campus. That is our first responsibility. But I'll tell you, Don, where we've invested a great deal of work is in a couple of areas, one of which is ongoing training. With our students, with our campus police and other campus security authorities. And the other has been pushing our folks out into the campus community. So we have adjunct police, our regular police, who are in the dorms. We want them to be part of our community and not some kind of outside group that's seen, you know, just breaking up parties and that type of thing. And we think the training and the kind of the community-based approach is going to be key for us going forward.
You have a full plate, my friend.
Well, so does everyone in this business, but we're very proud of what we do and appreciate the time.
I want to thank you so much, Dr. Randy Dunn, for being with us today and telling us about your institution, Southern Illinois University. Good luck to you.
Thanks, Don.
And when we come back, our man in Washington, Jim Howard, is going to bring us up to speed on what Congress is up to as it prepares for its summer recess. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.